Going to hear the third case for today in the March calendar, 97-3217 CR State versus Burge. Arguing for Mr. Burge is Stephen P. Weiss, Assistant State Public Defender. Mr. Weiss.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. This case, to me, is a very difficult case. A difficult case personally, it's a difficult case legally. Jeremy Burge, I would have to say, in the 25 years or so that I've been a public defender, is one of the most difficult clients that I've ever had to represent. The ultimate issue before the court today is whether or not Mr. Burge was competent to proceed at the time that he entered court, waived all of his rights, waived all of his possible defenses, and was sentenced to stay in prison until he died. The day that Burge appeared in court and waived his rights began early in the morning with Mr. Burge cutting himself with glass from a broken light fixture in his jail cell. He went to the hospital and received stitches and was returned to the jail. Later that morning before court, he had an altercation, a physical confrontation with his own trial lawyer. Following that confrontation, Mr. Burge's lawyer, the district attorney, and the judge met privately without Mr. Burge and agreed the only way Mr. Burge could appear in court that day was shackled, bound at the wrists, waist, and ankles into a wheelchair. That was done to protect the court personnel and his own lawyer. Burge was brought into court in that fashion and found competent to proceed in a very short proceeding. A short recess was taken, and Burge reappeared in court in the same condition and proceeded to move to withdraw his no-contest pleas made previously to the charge of first-degree murder and various other felonies. The trial judge summarily denied that request, and Burge's response was to summarily withdraw his insanity pleas, which was his only defense at that point in time, thereby guaranteeing his convictions and his being sentenced to life in prison.
And he was represented by counsel, and all this time he was represented by counsel.
Yes, he was.
And another question, and there were psychiatric testimony that he was competent. Is that?
There was one doctor who was appointed by the court to make a competency determination, Dr. Baker.
And that's what the trial court operated under, was knowing the testimony or the conclusion of that doctor.
The court adopted that doctor's conclusion, yes, sir.
And he had an opportunity to visit and interview your client?
He had an opportunity to interview. He did conduct a competency evaluation on him, although the trial judge mentioned that it was a somewhat unusual competency determination and that my client was very reluctant or hesitant, I believe were the words the trial judge used, to speak with the doctor. And I think the trial judge ultimately concluded at record 127-42, this is a quote that's in my brief as well, I'll just paraphrase it briefly. The trial judge said, you know, I can't explain what Mr. Burge is doing. Mr. Burge's lawyer can't explain what Mr. Burge is doing. Mr. Burge probably can't even explain what he's here doing. But Dr. Baker, even despite the unusual nature of the exams, claims he was able to sort it all out. And Dr. Baker is the expert, so we're just going to have to rely on Dr. Baker and find him competent.
And that's the final.
That was it. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I said that was essentially the entire ruling on the competency motion.
And you didn't present, I say you, your client did not present any evidence at that final hearing as to
incompetency.
So the judge was left with the appearance of the defendant, prior statements of psychiatrists or psychologists, and an uncontested determination by an expert witness of competence. Is that right?
I would say not uncontested. There was no countervailing evidence presented. Trial counsel made a one-sentence argument saying that his own observations led him to conclude that Mr. Burge was incompetent.
Now, the state points out, and, you know, there were three psychiatrists. It was Fosdale, Lorenz, and Baker. And as I read on page 29 of the state's brief, that Lorenz, who was defense psychiatrist, indicated that the report does not provide uncontradicted evidence of incompetence. So in other words, Lorenz, who was the psychiatrist for the defense, I assume, did not quarrel with Dr. Baker's decision as far as whether or not he was competent or incompetent.
I think that's incorrect, actually,
incorrect,
Your Honor.
Right.
Yes, what occurred was Dr. Lorenz, Dr. Baker, Dr. Lorenz, and Dr. Fosdell all performed evaluations of Mr. Burge prior to the competency proceeding. And they filed court reports on the insanity defense. In Dr. Lorenz's report on the insanity defense report, for which he was hired by the defense, he found Mr. Burge to be lifelong mental illness. He found Mr. Burge to be not guilty, in his opinion, by mental disease or defect, and in that report specifically included a paragraph stating that he had very serious questions as to Mr. Burge's ability to confer with counsel or to participate in the trial proceedings themselves. And he, in his own report, questioned Mr. Burge's competence. And it was that report, as well as trial counsel's own observations, that led trial counsel to file the competency motion.
What I was referring to, counsel, was this, 29 and 30. In his report, Lorenz expressed no opinion on Burge's competency to stand trial. Moreover, at the post-conviction hearing, Norvin was asked to explain why he did not ask Lorenz to evaluate Burge's for competency or call him as a witness. Darby stated, because Lorenz also told me in the past that it could be the verge of putting on and Jeremy's way of manipulating the system. And there's also the possibility that in the past I'm going to concede that there is certainly that possibility, quote and unquote. That's at page 30 and 31 of the state's brief.
Yes, Your Honor, and the record to a certain degree does reflect that. This case is, as I said, it's a very complicated posture somewhat, because I don't want to overstep the bounds of what this court has allowed me to argue today, but I felt, and I litigated through the trial court and appellate court levels, what I felt were substantial issues of trial counsel's actual competence in representing Mr. Burge and his effectiveness in how he handled the Lorenz situation. However, when this court granted the petition for review, it specifically directed that I was not permitted to go into the conduct of trial counsel. I was not permitted to argue the trial counsel's effective representation. I did not do so in my brief. I have many responses to Your Honor's suggestions. I feel I've been precluded from briefing what I felt were trial counsel's glaring deficiencies with regard to presenting Dr. Lorenz's testimony at the post-conviction hearing, with respect to never having even followed up by calling Dr. Lorenz to specifically ask Dr. Lorenz his opinion on Mr. Burge's competency.
Counsel.
What about
you've got a couple of things in mind. First of all, what authority can you cite for the proposition that we should be looking at any evidence outside of the competency hearing, any report outside of the competency hearing, any testimony outside of the competency hearing? Give me a case citation for authority that would allow for such review.
I have none, Your Honor.
Do you agree that our review, regardless of the standard of whether it be clearly erroneous or de novo, that our review, as the case currently is postured, with regard to the competency issue, is confined by the four corners and how many pages of the competency hearing?
I would suggest otherwise for two reasons, Your Honor.
Again, what, do you have authority for suggesting?
I could probably find authority for one of my reasons, the other one,
okay.
I'll just state. There are cases from this court and from federal courts suggesting that, for example, at a suppression hearing, when it's reviewed, the entire record may be reviewed, not simply the evidence taken at the suppression hearing. And I apologize, I can't spout those from the top of my head, but I'm certain I could find them if the court wants me to submit them.
As I recall, the state's brief took issue with you for that very reason. And the state said, defense doesn't cite any authority for the proposition that you can go outside the record. You didn't respond to that, I don't think, in the reply brief. The state then continues on and says, but for the sake of for completeness, the misstatement.
Yes.
So you maintain there is authority that we can review the competency hearing determination by going outside the
house. I believe that following from the precedent concerning suppression hearings and other various things like that, that the entire record is before the court. I would also argue strenuously, and I have mentioned in my briefs, that this is a case that I feel may well be appropriate for a discretionary interest of justice reversal, which this court obviously has the discretion to do based upon the entire record. And that is the other basis upon which I would assert that Your Honors could review the entire case to determine whether or not justice was done here, whether or not the system functioned as it should in this case. So for those two reasons, I think it's appropriate to look at the entire record. And once again, I keep coming close to the line of discussing why I feel the record as it exists may not be a fully adequate record upon which the trial judge, nor the Court of Appeals, nor this court could make a full and fair competency determination.
Why shouldn't we, with regard, and I ask this question a bit rhetorically, why shouldn't we, with regard to the issue of whether or not the defendant has to be advised of parole, why shouldn't we, in view of truth in sentencing, improvidently grant that? I say it's improvidently granted. We no longer have parole, and so it's not likely to recur. It's not a matter of statewide import.
It's only non-existent for those cases in which the crimes are committed after January of 2000. There's a slew of cases in the pipeline that are certainly under the old law, and the fact is that this only applies to first-degree murder Class A felony sentencings, and there's no statute of limitations on those cases, so we may well be dealing with these cases well into the future. So for that reason, I would urge the court to address that issue. Certainly, it may become less relevant as truth in sentencing becomes the norm. It's also entirely possible that truth in sentencing will go the way of parole in the future, and the issue as to whether or not that particular advice should be given on the record or not, I think, is simply one of those administration of justice issues. I would point out to the court that the court's decision on that issue will in no way affect this particular conviction, because the trial judge did make a finding that Mr. Burge was aware, through discussions with his counsel. So in other words, the question number one is, should it be part of the colloquy that the judge must perform? And then, as we know under State versus Bankert, if the colloquy is defective, to get relief, the defense must show an actual lack of knowledge. So I'm suggesting we have a problem with the colloquy, but not with actual knowledge. So in that sense, it's a purely a legal issue. And I think, given the posture of the case, it should be decided. Particularly now there's a decision saying it is not necessary.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Your
yes, sir.
Didn't
Yes, the exact sequence of events. I'm sorry. I would question his competence throughout this entire proceeding. There was no evidence at that moment upon which anyone could make a substantial argument one way or the other. He was charged in August of 94. He pled not guilty in September of 1994 following his prelim. In October of 94, he amended the pleas to include an insanity plea. And then 3 weeks later, for reasons completely unexplained on the record, he appeared in court and pled no contest to the substantive felony charges. And this was prior to any of the psychiatric examiners even having met with him. I think there is, Your Honor, and it has to do with the nature of competency itself. Competency is not something which we assume or presume. Competency is something which must exist at the moment. Competency is something that, when it's questioned, the state has the obligation to come forward and prove. Unlike the insanity defense, where the defendant has the burden of coming forward and saying, no, I was insane, competency is something that the state must prove to the court's satisfaction prior to proceeding. So I would say the difference there would take it out of that presumption area. It was not questioned at that point in time. No, sir. It was not questioned until that motion was filed, which was following the psychiatric reports, because as trial counsel stated, the actual motion is the last page in my brief in the appendix. That was filed on April of 1998. April 1995. And the situation was there. Counsel stated that he was making that motion based upon his reading of the psychiatric evaluation on the not guilty by insanity plea filed by Dr. Lorenz. Which brings me a little bit back to Justice Wilcox's question concerning, do I agree that the state, in terms of whether there was any competency evidence from Dr. Lorenz. So the court was not on notice that Attorney Norby, trial counsel, was having difficulties with Mr. Burge until that day in April. The first legal issue that I'd like to address, and again, this is in some ways similar to my mind to the colloquy issue, in that the court's actual decision on the standard of review issue, de novo versus clearly erroneous of the competency determination, is once again an issue that I don't feel is dispositive to Mr. Burge's convictions. I feel under either standard, this court can and should vacate Mr. Burge's convictions because he was not competent. But within our law and this court's lawmaking function, I think the Garfoot decision must be re-examined.
Is the finding of legal competence a factual finding or a legal conclusion?
I would argue very strongly, Your Honor, that it's a legal conclusion.
Why is that?
Because, first off, it's of constitutional magnitude. It requires a judge to apply constitutional standards to the historic facts. And this court is obviously well aware of the difference between a historical fact and a constitutional fact. One is a legal conclusion, one is a specific fact that could be found by a trier of fact. And the competency determination going all the way back has always been a judicial determination. And the state in its brief at page 35 quotes from the state ex rel Haskins case, and it says, quoting now from this court, the determination of competency to stand trial is a judicial matter, and a finding is not to be made on the basis of rubber stamping the report of a psychiatrist. It's a judicial matter. I don't presume to be more eloquent than Justice Abrahamson in her concurrence in the Garfoot case, but the logic to me seems inescapable that when we're confronted with the situation where the doctors can testify as to their opinions of the man's orientation to time and place, his ability to communicate, his rational understanding, yet the judge must decide, is this man or woman capable at this moment of participating?
Legal competence is wrapped up, at least as I perceive it, to involve, to a large extent, it's not completely the state of mind. I will ask you.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that.
And it seems to me that this is at least arguably, a determination that is far better able to be made by the observer of this defendant, of this person, than are we, who have only a cold record.
I would strongly disagree with that, Your Honor, for several reasons. First of all, in these situations, the record and the observations of the judge are almost the least important evidence. First of all, if indeed we agree that the medical evidence is highly paramount in these cases, the medical evidence is in the record. Dr. Baker's competency report is filed. It's reviewable by a reviewing court to the same extent it's reviewable by the trial court. One can read the report. Dr. Baker's testimony is fully in the record, and in fact, he testified by telephone, so he never appeared in court for any eyeball-to-eyeball with the trial judge. And if we're going to simply go by the physical appearance of the defendant rather than his spoken words or tone, which can be put onto the record, in this case, that's in the record also. He was so agitated that the trial judge didn't feel safe having him in court unless he was strapped into a chair, kind of Hannibal Lecter-like. And that's all before this court with the same vividness, I believe, that it would have been before the trial judge. And the ultimate issue then becomes, given those facts, was the man able and competent to make the rational, meaningful decisions and participate in the case in a rational and meaningful way? And that, Your Honors, is purely a legal conclusion. It's no different, for example, from a voluntariness issue, where we have, you know, maybe a dozen witnesses testifying to the police conduct and whether the defendant was sweating or hungry or smoking. And then the trial judge says, I find the facts to be the defendant had a donut, had a cup of coffee, the police did not overstep these bounds, the police acted this way factually. Yet the determination of ultimate voluntariness based on those facts is a legal one that this court has no trouble making. And in my brief, I mentioned the Phillips case, which was decided a year after Garfoot, premising that, well, this is so fact-oriented and so observational-oriented as to the credibility of the various witnesses that only the trial judge should do it. And this court, in no uncertain terms, said the fact-based nature is irrelevant. This is a legal conclusion.
And, why is parole advising the defendant of the parole option set forth in the statute a direct consequence rather than a collateral consequence?
I would say in this particular situation, and mind I'm limiting this specifically to the statute 973.014, where the trial judge and the trial judge alone sets and determines the parole eligibility or the complete lack of any possibility for parole. In all the other cases, and in this case's decision in Burtz versus the state, that's not true. Here, the trial judge in his sole or her sole discretion determines whether the man will ever be paroled or not. And that makes it, it's just as much an exercise of sentencing discretion as is the length of the sentence in any other case.
What's the test of what constitutes a direct consequence?
There are two. One is whether it's punitive in nature, and one is whether it automatically flows as part of the judge's sentencing exercise. And I would argue in this case, the withholding of parole or the setting of parole by the trial judge under 973.014 meets both of those tests. The judge can be more punitive or less punitive by extending parole or allowing an early parole or denying parole entirely, as in this case. And this flows directly to the judge's sentencing discretion. Nothing, and no one can affect the parole eligibility under that statute except the judge, which is exactly the opposite situation of the Burks case, where the judge could have no effect whatsoever on the parole situation. Here, the parole board, the Department of Corrections, no one.
I'm concerned about the consequences. I'm concerned about the consequences of this case, both in terms of overturning a multitude of first-degree cases, as this is, and also the consequence of that rationale extending to truth in sentencing, because under truth in sentencing, indeed, the court, no longer the parole board, has the power to control the extent of its supervision, which is the rationale you are using to distinguish this from the first situation. So can you respond to me as to the consequences of both as you see this case?
Certainly. I don't see this as a floodgates case. As I pointed out, even in this case, this will do Mr. Burge no relief. And secondly, so I don't think there's reason to assume in many, many other first-degree murder cases. First of all, it only applies to a small number of cases since the enactment of 973014. And in many of those cases, there will be no challenge, and the record may be the same as it is here.
That's what, 88, 89, something like that, the statute was?
I have it.
Okay, but I mean, it's
a
few years ago. It's not.
Yes, it's not brand new, but it's not within the realm of our criminal jurisprudence, particularly old either. And turning to the truth in sentencing, my recollection is, and I don't fancy myself an expert in that area yet, I haven't seen a case of it yet, that the jury instruction committee, the latest draft of it, was indicating that the trial judge did have the obligation to discuss both the incarceration period and the extended supervision period as part of the maximum penalty. And perhaps just the Sykes, I believe, is on the committee. May be able to better answer that. I know I saw a presentation. I believe that's what Judge Fiedler indicated at the last.
The terminology in the law is imprisonment comprises both the confinement component as well as the extended supervision component of the sentence.
So the entire period would be discussed with the accused. My red light's been on quite a while here, so I'll be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'll get out of the way.
If you're sentenced to 20 years, they don't really stay in prison for 20 years.
Well, it depends. And we can talk about that.
It might be 4 and 16 separated by 20 years.
Okay. Right. I'll give you the short course.
All right. The answer is no, it doesn't mean necessarily 20 years. Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel, Ms. Wellman, she's Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the state.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman representing the state. I think perhaps the issue regarding the intertwined issue regarding the standard of review and whether this court should find that the trial court was wrong in finding Mr. Burke to be competent is sort of crystallized as to where we part company by the defense statement in his opening argument of the issue. He says the ultimate issue is whether Mr. Burge was competent. And I beg to differ. It seems to me this appellate court role is to determine whether the trial court erred in finding Mr. Burge to be competent.
What's the standard of review?
We believe that the standard of review in Garfoot is appropriate, the deferential review that this court will not overturn trial court's determination of competency unless it's clearly erroneous.
When the trial court makes that determination, is that a legal conclusion?
It has a legal effect, certainly.
Well, there's a legal standard.
There is a legal standard, absolutely.
So trial court is making a determination that the legal standard has been met.
Yes, yes.
Now, why
is
that a question of law?
I think that it could be characterized as either, and I think that's part of the problem with labeling, because I think, as Garfoot recognized, the real issue isn't so much what we label it, but how much deference do we give to the trial court? Who's in the better position to decide it? Because Garfoot recognized, although, yes, you're applying a legal standard, it's highly, highly factual, and it's factual in a different way than other determinations. For example, in a voluntariness determination, yeah, the trial court is assessing the credibility of various witnesses to determine what happened and possibly a state of mind, what was said and done. At a past point in time, the trial court wasn't there. In the competency determination, similar to the jury bias situation, the trial court is observing directly and interacting with the person involved. This trial court interacted with Mr. Berg on a number of occasions in taking his plea, in taking his withdrawal of his insanity plea, and he observed him interacting with counsel in the courtroom. And there are a lot of dynamics and nuances that go into that, and particularly in a case like this, that help a trial court determine, for example, this incident where Mr. Berg cut himself on the arm, then put a quarter-sized piece of glass in his mouth, had to go to the hospital, no evidence at all that it was life-threatening or a serious injury in any way. The trial court, observing him, observing his other interactions, was in a better position than this appellate court on a cold record to determine whether that was evidence of a serious mental disorder that might prevent him from being competent, or whether it was attention-getting behavior, manipulative behavior, a last-minute attempt to delay the last stage of the trial court proceedings and get on the bus to go to prison. And because of that interactive nature and because of the immediacy of the decision, I think it's appropriate for it to be highly deferential. Now,
how does that differ from voluntariness determination to the conclusion that a confession is voluntary?
Well, because I think particularly in voluntariness, you don't even get to the question of the defendant's actual state of mind unless there's police misconduct or police impropriety. If there's no police wrongdoing or impropriety, overreaching, lying to the defendant, all, you know, those kinds of, you know, threatening him, starving him, all kinds of things. If you don't have any of that, then you never even get to the voluntariness question. So many, many voluntariness questions really focus on police behavior and giving guidance to police officers about what is acceptable and not. If you have enough police wrongdoing, you probably never really get to the state of mind because you don't really look then to see, well, even though, you know, they starved him and they beat him and they told him they were going to kill his children, this particular defendant was so strong-minded that his will wasn't overcome. You just don't do that. So it's really not the same kind of state of mind, factual, you know, issue.
Counsel, assume that Garfoot doesn't exist. Then what's the answer to the question?
I think the answer is the same, and I think this court would look to guidance to the United States Supreme Court cases, which, although you can quarrel about whether the first case, Maggio versus Fulford, really meant to say it's a matter of law, there's no question now that repeatedly, and most recently in Thompson versus, I think it's pronounced Keyhone or Keyhane, written by Justice Ginsburg, that on federal habeas review, the federal court will treat a trial court's finding of competency as a question of fact for those very reasons, that it's so fact-bound and so intertwined and so immediate and contextual that even though it's a legal standard, like jury bias, they'll treat it as a finding of fact. And while certainly, I mean, habeas is a different state-federal interaction and a different procedure, I think the rationale is the same, that
your opposing counsel raises Phillips' case, I believe. How do you respond to that?
Well, Phillips was a totally different issue. Phillips was whether the defendant's consent was should be reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard or not. And that's much closer, I think, to the voluntariness situation. While we're looking at the actual defendant's consent, we're also very, very concerned about what the police did and the consent in that context. Having said that if the clearly erroneous standard is appropriate, and I see no reason for this court to overturn Garfoot, I do want to make sure that you clearly understand that as it was in Garfoot, our position is that nonetheless this court can review for a legal error in the sense of if the court applied a wrong legal standard. For example, Dusty, the forerunner of all of these cases, the error there was the trial court, the state trial court, or the federal trial court, had said that the person was competent because he was oriented to time and place. And the U.S. Supreme Court, with the government's agreement, said, no, that's not enough, that's not the correct test. I think similarly, if a trial court, for example, were to say, well, the defendant is quiet in court, he's not acting out, he's not banging on the table, he's not misbehaving, he's not sleeping, he's not drooling, and I'm going to find him competent and refuse to look at any of the medical evidence or reports or hear any testimony, I think this court could say, you know, that was legal error, not that we're saying, well, you know, it's clearly erroneous as much as you used the wrong test or you didn't look at what you were supposed to. Or, for example, suppose a trial court were to say, well, he does understand the proceedings. You know, if you ask him what is the trial, who is the person in the black robe, who is the defense counsel, he can tell you those things. He's not, you know, so retarded that he's not functional. But he won't tell his defense counsel anything because there's uncontradicted evidence that he has a psychiatric disorder that's created a delusion that he genuinely and consistently believes that his defense counsel is an alien and that this alien controls his mind and his life, and if he says anything to him, he will destroy him. If that were true, then I think you could say as a matter of law, the trial court was wrong.
Let's just take the facts of this case. The only thing in the record of the competency hearing is Dr. Baker's testimony.
And his written report, which is quite thorough.
And both the testimony and the written report are, as we say in the law, clear and unequivocal. I mean, several times he repeats, in my opinion, after examining the defendant, he is able to cooperate with counsel and assist and in his own defense, and therefore is competent to stand trial. That opinion is set forth three different times, I believe, on page 2 of his report, and was set forth several times upon questioning in the competency hearing. Let's say that everything that we have here today, guy in the wheelchair, shackled, eating the glass the night before, except trial judge. I don't care what Dr. Baker has said three times in his report and many times in the record. I don't care. That's the only thing that we have in the record. I don't think this guy is competent. I can look at him. He just doesn't seem competent to me. Would you be here in court arguing for de novo review?
I think I would be in court. It's not always my decision personally.
We would be arguing the exact opposite that you are now.
Well, we would be arguing for reversal. And I think we would be arguing a combination. We might well be arguing that it was clearly erroneous because in light of all of the other evidence. But I think there's a legal component there, too, that trial court, as you described
that's
it,
that's my point.
He didn't link it to competency through a mental condition.
How can you have it both ways? How can you argue that this is clearly erroneous because the trial court is in the best position, standing right there, looking at those eyes, looking at the movement, looking at what's going on. So it's got to be clearly erroneous. But trial court had decided differently based on this record?
Well, I guess, and maybe it's a matter of degree, but I think we're parting company on this example, is that if, for example, you had evidence that this expert was saying he's competent because I think all of his destructive behaviors and his actions are manipulation, and he can control it. Right.
Why?
And the trial court does not draw that inference. I mean, I think there's a difference between we defer to him because he draws inferences based on what he sees and hears in his interaction with the defendant, and saying when there is absolutely no evidence of that he lacks substantial mental capacity, as the law requires, there's no evidence of mental disorder or mental illness or mental condition. There's no evidence from which the trial court could conclude, I believe he's unable due to a psychosis rather than unwilling. I mean, I see your example as just, well, I know him when I see one. I look at him, I look at his eyes, he's incompetent. And I don't think that's enough. And whether you want to say it's not enough because it's clearly erroneous, or it's not enough because he's not looking at the things the law requires, I agree. I mean, I think you could label it either one. I think what's really important here is if this court is going to look at doing a de novo review, or call it a mixed question, or call it, well, we give deference, but we look a little harder at it, as one of the federal courts I did, I think. My sense is that they kind of threw up their hands and came up with that language. But I think what's really important is that when you do that, looking at it, you are very, very careful of still that you have to give deference to the factual portion. You can't just substitute your judgment on the facts or the inferences. And particularly in this case, where Mr. Berg is asking you to draw that finding of inference, not on the basis of cross-examination of the doctor who testified at the competency hearing, but not on the basis of factual findings by the trial court that he says are clearly erroneous, but on the basis of things that the trial court never even got to test and hear in testimony. And so he's either asking you to draw an inference from Dr. Lorenz's report that because he questions his ability to distinguish reality, and because he questions his ability to assist because he won't tell his counsel the truth, he's either asking you to draw a factual inference that because he has antisocial personality disorder and lies a lot and won't cooperate with counsel, then he must be incompetent. And you can't draw that factual inference.
What's the factual inference?
That because he has an antisocial personality disorder and because he lies a lot, which is consistent with the disorder, he is therefore unable to assist counsel.
So what's the factual inference? Unable to assist counsel.
And that it's linked to, his personality disorder is causing that inability.
Okay.
As opposed, like a psychotic illness would cause the delusion, and then the delusion would cause him to be unable to.
That's a factual inference, and I would say here that the appellate court can't draw that because the trial court found him competent. Therefore, the trial court did not find that factual. You have to find factual inferences to support the trial court, right?
Right. Well, and the trial court did more than that. I mean, the trial court heard specific evidence that he was able but unwilling, and he found that evidence credible.
No, I agree with that. But that goes to the issue that on facts, which includes reasonable inferences from facts, right? The standard of our review is clearly erroneous. That doesn't answer the next part of the question, then. Assuming all those facts, which you accept, which the appellate court has to accept, that from those facts you draw the legal conclusion he is or is not competent. Now, I don't understand how you can say on the legal conclusion part, you can do a clearly erroneous test. Either it is the law, the legal conclusion, or it isn't the legal conclusion. It's not clearly erroneous kind of. Now you see, I
went back and read Garfield and parts of your brief, and there were several standards set forth in Garfield. First, there was a standard that the defendant took, which supported his position here, which is not what this defendant is taking. Then it was your standard, and when I say yours, I mean the state. I don't remember if you were.
I did not draft it for you, counsel.
And then third, there was the Court of Appeals standard, and fourth, there was the standard that the majority adopted. Now, the Court of Appeals standard, which I hear from you, but I don't think it's the one that was adopted in Garfield, was that as to facts, they would do the clearly erroneous. But when you ultimately find the court's legal conclusion, it's de novo. But then to give deference, because it's an intertwining of facts and law, so that you have a de novo review, but you recognize that this is all wrapped up, and citing a civil case, but there have been cases since then that take the same approach. De novo, but watch out, because it's a very wrapped up kind of legal conclusion. So now, which exactly is your position today? Is it just clearly erroneous, which is the majority's position in Garfield?
No, I think our position is what was summarized in the Garfoot concurrence footnote that was in our Garfoot position, which is slightly different from the Court of Appeals,
that's
which
right.
is as long as the trial court applies the proper legal standard, then it's clearly erroneous. And, you know, we may be fighting about just drawing lines in different places here, but it seems to me that what we're trying to get at there is, one, you don't draw your own inferences. You don't just look at an entire record and say, well, I think I would have found him incompetent, or I think he's incompetent. You're bound by the inferences stated, explicit, reasonable by the trial court. Once you've got that and you've got the legal test, then it seems to me that you can only find the trial court erred if he made a legal error in applying that legal test. And in this case, I would say the trial, we accept the trial court finding that Mr. Berg was unwilling as opposed to unable by his mental disorder, unwilling to assist with counsel. And suppose the trial court had said, well, I think if he's unwilling to talk to counsel and tell him the truth and cooperate, then he can't be competent, because how can he assist his counsel? I would call that a legal error. And I would say, yes, you review that de novo. That's not what being...
Thank you.
capacity to assist counsel means. And I think that's where, you know, I think that's where we're really parting company. And what my concern here is not so much the label as that either you will buy into making your own factual inferences that Mr. Berg is asking you to do based on the Lorenz report and the Porter language, or he's asking you to just sort of slide into saying, well, unwilling constitutes incompetency, or he was unable to make reasonable decisions committed by law to the defendant with a reasonable degree of rational understanding because he made poor decisions that we can look back as appellate counsel and say, well, I don't think that was his best interest. All he had was an insanity defense. He ought to have gone forward with it. And those are the dangers. And if that's what somebody means by independent or de novo review, then we're very, very concerned about it.
And do you think your standard, that is the state standard, which is set forth in the footnote in Garwood, in my concurrence.
Yes,
it's footnote 11. Is that the same standard as adopted by the majority opinion?
I think it's the same. I think the majority opinion just didn't address the other aspect of it.
It's not.
So I don't think it's different. Well, I guess my impression, my understanding is if the majority had expressly addressed it, it would have said, yes, of course, we also mean we can review for legal error or, you know, the wrong legal standard. So I don't see it as different in the sense I never have read the majority to say, no, we don't think you can even do that. I hope I'm not wrong, but.
Well, that's the issue I'm driving at because it's not a mere factual determination. It is a factual and a legal determination. And
right.
I think that place of parting is whether when you make the ultimate legal conclusion of competency, I agree with you, you cannot change the facts, you cannot change the inferences that the trial judge would have made and they would have supported him. But then the question is, when they take all of that, does it equal competency?
Right, and I guess
that's
I...
Denial.
Yeah, and I guess I see that really breaking down even further, is if you're not saying it was legal error, i.e. you equated unwillingness with unable, or you equated bad decisions, poor choices with inability to make choices, if it's not that kind of error and you use the Dusky standard or the 170-113 standard, then it seems to me the only other thing that you could be labeling de novo or independent is how you weight the facts. And
sure, that's right.
And I'm not sure in this particular context, I mean, it makes more sense to me in a voluntariness context where you can say, yes, the defendant had coffee and he had cigarettes and he was 39 years old and he'd been to high school and the police told him, you know, we'd really like you to get to go home tonight and take care of your kids, but if you don't talk to us, you know, those kiddies are going to be home alone at night. But on the other hand, you know, he'd been there before, he talked to the police, sometimes he got out, sometimes he didn't. It makes a little more sense to me when you're weighing those kinds of factors. Do you think that telling the defendant you might not see your kids, we might take your kids away, whatever it would be, do we think that outweighs the other things that are not coercive, as opposed to, and in this case it's really hard because we didn't have any contradicting evidence at the competency hearing, but suppose...
I think it's limited to the competency hearing. I mean, we usually look at the whole
Well, you usually
record.
Do. I mean, the only way that I can see that you wouldn't be is if you were reviewing the ineffective assistance aspect, which you've chosen not to do. I don't know. Mr. Weiss is correct. We just had a conversation about pronunciation. Mr. Weiss is correct that in some of the suppression cases, the court has said, you know, we can look at the entire record. My recollection of those cases, and it's only my recollection because I never even thought to look in that area since he didn't argue that, was that those are upholding trial court decisions. And they don't look at the contradictory facts that the trial court never got a chance to evaluate. So I'm troubled by that.
But you do that for a plea. Accepting the plea also.
the whole record.
But that's because the question at that point is, did the defendant really know it even though the colloquy was defective? So it's a different question, I think.
Well, you have a ruling by the court of accepting the plea. The court accepts the plea on the basis that the court thinks he understood everything.
Right, but usually that comes up as, yes, I said I understood, but I really didn't, or something that wasn't talked about, and so he makes or one of the steps wasn't gone through.
But in all of this, this is evidence that the trial court heard before it made its determination. It's not after the fact. In this case,
it's after the fact. I mean, it did not look at the Lorenz report in the context of the competency. It came into the record only because at the conclusion, the prosecutor said, I'm worried about it, you know, we see so much ineffectiveness, we want to get these in the record. And he did look at them at the ineffective assistance hearing, where he found that the report was not enough to conclude that there was evidence of incompetency that would have changed the competency result.
So the problem is that we didn't take the ineffective assistance.
Well, I mean, I think that makes it much more difficult to review it. But even if you review it, I think, you know, the key point is, you know, you're really tied to either you have to say that the Lorenz report as a matter of law establishes competency, or you're into fact-finding, because otherwise, almost by definition, you've got to be drawing inferences from what Lorenz said in the report, which he's never even explained, much less had the opportunity to cross-examine. So that's the problem I have with looking at the whole record.
Counsel, I feel the need to move on to other issues.
Sure.
Direct consequence, issue of whether or not the defendant has to be advised of the parole aspect. Here we have a case where under 973.014, the court has three options. One, the first option, I think the court takes that. That means the defendant is eligible for parole in, what, 13 years, 4 months, something like that.
Something like that. My math is not good, but something like that.
The second option under the statute, which the court did use in this case to set parole. The court set parole for the year 2095. The third option is the court can say, you are never going to get parole. Now, it seems to me, not only might the defendant be mildly interested in being advised of that, but that according to the definition of direct consequence, that is constituting punishment and automatically flows from the sentence, that it is a direct consequence. Can you explain to me your position?
It's not a direct
consequence. It seems, besides legally, it just seems so intuitively that it is. Then we can get to the law, too.
It's not a direct consequence because whether you will be eligible for parole or when you will be eligible for parole is not a given, because the court can choose any of those three. Actually, at the time of Mr. Berg's trial crime, the third one did not exist. The court could not have said no parole, period, ever. They could now, but they couldn't then, just so you're clear on that. But for the legal argument, it doesn't matter. It's not a direct consequence because it may or may not happen. It's like a Chapter 980 proceeding, I think, that, yes, you plead guilty to first-degree sexual assault. The state may or may not bring a sexually violent person petition against you at some future point in time, but we don't know whether that will happen or not. And here, at the time you plead, we don't know which of the three options. You might get the statutory eligibility or you might not. That's why it's not direct, I think.
Let's test. Isn't it just a straight-up analysis of whether this constitutes advising the defendant of the potential punishment if convicted under 971-01A, disregarding the direct and collateral distinction, and just look at what the statute says the judge must do, and the judge must advise the defendant personally on the record of the potential maximum penalty, and in the case of other classified felonies, that tops out at a certain number of years. And in the case of life, it means the rest of your natural life.
Right.
Why shouldn't it be the obligation of the judge to say that to the defendant at the time?
Well, I agree with the first half, and not the second half. The first half, I agree. I think it seems to me the much more natural and clean analysis to just say, is he being advised of the punishment, as that term means, or the range of punishment, as some of the cases talk about? And it seems to me that then the question is, well, what does that mean? It clearly doesn't include normally parole options. It doesn't include when a person's put on probation, that if you're on probation for 5 years, if you do good for 4.5 years and then you get revoked, you're going to serve all that time. You don't have to tell him that, even though it could be considered part of the punishment. I think the key is he has to know, worst case scenario, what's the worst that I'll serve? And he was told that, life. It can't get much simpler. Worst case scenario, you are going to serve life in prison and never get out. And that's inherent in telling you life.
But is that what he was told?
He was told it was the maximum was life imprisonment, period. That's all he was told by the court. Now, as Mr. Berg admits, he actually knew it because counsel told him. So this is a non-issue in this case. But, and I see my red light is now on, so
I... question.
Sure.
In your argument at home, you cited a case from the U.S. Supreme Court and Justice Ginsburg.
Yes, and that is Thompson versus Keohane. It's in our brief at pages 9 and 10.
Okay.
The full site.
Chief,
yeah.
Yes, certainly. With regard to the final issue, the viability of the first Court of Appeals opinions, need we and or should we get to that issue to resolve this case?
You don't have to resolve this case, obviously. I think the Court of Appeals would very much like you to, because they feel that they, at least according to their certification, which was not accepted, since they are bound by their own decisions, and then they're not sure which decisions that means, because if something's reversed but it doesn't expressly reverse all the parts of it. In this case, I think it's an easy answer, because what this court said in Bentley was you never should have reached the merits because procedurally he didn't show enough to even get there. And it seems to me that it's so intertwined that inherently it has to mean we've overruled all of it. I think there are lots and lots of closer questions and permutations of that. And I would be perfectly satisfied if you just made it clear no part of the Court of Appeals Bentley decision is good law anymore. As to when else we should expressly overrule, or maybe we should flip the presumption, or not the presumption, but the assumption that if we don't expressly say we're overruling, I really think that that's too big for this case, and it would be more appropriate for rulemaking where you can look at all the different permutations. That's a long answer to a simple question. But
thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Weiss.
Yeah, very briefly, I'll try to. It's pretty complicated. If the court reads the actual psychiatric report of Dr. Lorenz, and if the court closely reads the testimony when I cross-examined trial counsel at the Mochner hearing concerning his investigation of the competency question with Dr. Lorenz, it develops that Dr. Lorenz said in his report that this man is absolutely not competent to proceed. I question his abilities at every level to participate in this trial. And you find that, in my opinion, and what I understood trial counsel's answers, and the transcript is obviously part of the record from the post-conviction hearing, to have indicated that he never actually specifically followed up with Dr. Lorenz at all concerning the competency issue. And if the court closely reads the transcript with the flavor of what was proceeding that morning before the competency hearing, where this trial lawyer in his first-degree murder case, is basically in there telling the judge, "Judge, I don't have a clue what's going on here. I don't have a clue how to proceed. I don't know what to do here. So we'll just go and do something." And you compare his testimony at the post-conviction hearing a year or two later, when he himself felt undoubtedly that he was on trial rather than Mr. Burge, which is the unfortunate nature of those types of proceedings, his answers were completely inconsistent and completely different. I touched upon those in my reply brief, and I invite the court to examine the completely different flavors of his testimony after the fact, which the state relied upon in its brief, and his actual contemporaneous remarks and his behavior. Many of your honors have been trial judges, and I'm certain that you can read between the lines and see the flavor of that proceeding the morning of the competency hearing, where the lawyer is discussing having his client bound into a chair for his own protection while we move along to have his competency hearing. And, you know, there's just a plethora of evidence that was never argued and never presented to the trial judge. I pointed out, and I know it comes after the fact, but it's only 2 weeks after the fact of the competency hearing. 2 weeks after that day, Dr. Porter, who is a psychiatrist, psychologist for the Department of Corrections, certainly not biased on behalf of Mr. Burge, wrote, and it's cited in my briefs, that he questioned whether this man had any ability to differentiate reality from fantasy. This is the state's corrections psychologist, 2 weeks after the day this man was in court, found competent, and sentenced to die in prison.
Do you think there's a difference between
all of those facts,
mental illness and competence?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the fact of the matter is, and the law of the matter is, that competency does not require any finding of mental illness whatsoever. Insanity requires... I'm sorry.
Dr. Lorenz gave several diagnoses, I think the primary one, antisocial behavior disorder, and that seems to be one that we see a lot. That was
sociopathic, psychopathic conduct.
But in looking at the report, what words do you refer to on the issue of competency? I didn't see where Dr. Lorenz opined on competency to proceed.
In my brief at page 5, I quote from the written report of Dr. Lorenz. It's record 97 at page 5 for the record citation. The last paragraph of that long quote in bold-faced type.
This was his first report?
This was Dr. Lorenz's report on the insanity
case.
Yes.
Okay, this is before our determination of competency.
This was filed before the competency determination, and this was the basis that trial counsel raised in his competency motion, where he stated, based on Dr. Lorenz's report. And Dr. Lorenz specifically says, at that point, his judgment as to what he thinks others want to believe is so impaired that his contact with reality has to be questioned. And this, of course, is the exact same language that Dr. Porter used 2 weeks later. He says, although he is oriented to time, place, and person, I question his judgment, his capability to confer with his attorney, or to prepare statements regarding this tragedy. So I interpret, when we speak of his ability to confer with his attorney and his being oriented but not being in touch with reality, as being a very clear comment on his competency. And I think even trial counsel felt that, because trial counsel's motion was premised in large part on that. Although trial counsel also admitted he never specifically spoke to Dr. Lorenz about that.
Wait a second. Can you go through that again? This is at the Mockner hearing?
Yes.
Where the trial attorney was asked to explain why he didn't ask for a second opinion on competency after Dr. Baker came in with his opinion?
He was not asked that specifically. He was asked why he didn't proceed. On questioning by the district attorney, he was asked why he didn't present Dr. Lorenz as a witness.
Well, Dr. Lorenz had been asked to evaluate competency.
Exactly.
Why didn't he ask for a second doctor's report on competency?
He was very vague as to his reasons in that regard. I asked him those questions, and I was dissatisfied with the answers, but
we don't have.
We have his written report. The state made some issue that I should have called Dr. Lorenz at the post-conviction hearing, which I made a tactical decision not to do, because I felt the report itself and the other reports viewed together was sufficient to demonstrate that trial counsel should have done more at that point in time to present the competency question to the judge. I see my red lights on.
Thanks.
I won't take the opportunity to sum up.
All right.
If the court hopefully understands where I'd
like to go. Wise, thank you. Ms. Wellman, thank you. That concludes our hearings for today. We shall have our third day of oral argument tomorrow beginning at 9:45.